The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back as we head into hour two. It is a delight to welcome back to the show David Marcus. If you ask David, I've interviewed him several times and I've listened to him and read him a lot. If you ask David what he does, he'd probably just say, I'm a writer. That's what I do. I write. He is a writer. He is a columnist. His most recent book is Charade, The COVID Lies That Crushed a Nation. You can read him in any number of platforms, including the Daily Mail. Very active Twitter X Twix feed at Blue Box Dave, and fairly regular on the, at least as I see it, the Megyn Kelly podcast. David, welcome back to the airwaves of Phoenix. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
Did I say anything? That's what you would say. If someone said, what do? You'd say, I'm a writer. I think you'd say that, right?
That's it, man. It's like from Hamlet, you know, Polonius walks in, he says, what do you read, my lord? Words.
That's what you do. And you're a different kind of writer, I hope you'll allow me to say. You may or may not describe yourself as a conservative. I would. I think you're a conservative writer. You write on the from a more conservative perspective, but it's a little different. I mean, you bring in a certain cultural element with just the right amount of first person observation that you allow into your writing. And it's almost always unpredictable where you end up, if you'll allow me that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. You know, my background was in theater, so I spent a good 10 or 15 years as an actor, playwright, producer. I was in the New York theater scene, right? It's all storytelling. So, yeah, for me, it's important to sort of be on the ground and understand what's actually happening and just try to be a conduit for my readers. And what's really important is honesty. And I think I think it's so important today because nobody trusts the news media. And that's a real problem because our industry doesn't work if you don't have some level of trust. And that trust has been broken down.
Maybe that's why I can get away with saying we don't always know where you're going to end up. Maybe the better way to put it is, yeah, let me stay on that for a moment, the honesty part, because they're related. I sometimes tick off my listeners. I sometimes tick off the base. But what I think they reward me with over time is what you get rewarded with over time, track record. Track record. You're not always going to toe the popular line because something about it you know a little bit more about perhaps than the populace does that is towing it, or perhaps you just have a better experience with that kind of thing. And I think at the end of the day, you are rewarded for track record, not taking low-hanging fruit. I think.
Yeah. And sometimes
I've been doing this 20 years for that, based on that, I think.
And sometimes I'm just wrong, man. Like that happens too. But one of my great moments when I was writing at the Federalist was I was convinced that Anthony Scaramucci was exactly the man that Donald Trump needed.
Okay, well, you weren't wrong for long. I mean, it didn't take long to discover you were wrong.
No, I read a column that one morning at the Federalist. There was a column by me that said, the man that Trump needs, and Anthony Scaramucci, 3 hours later, he got fired.
Well, you probably were man enough to admit it, which also is the other part of track record. When we're wrong,
right.
Do we
That's
promptly
true.
Admit it, as they say, I think, in 12-step meetings. I think that's a phrase in there. Anyway, it's a phrase somewhere. David Marcus, so you just recently went on a trip to Israel. I wouldn't normally point this out, what I'm about to, but you have written it, so it's no secret, and I just think it's important for perspective. You went on this trip to Israel. You are yourself not Jewish. That's what I thought was interesting to point out in the way you pointed it out and the perspective you came away from. Take us anywhere you want, or take us through what you learned and saw when you were in Israel.
Yeah, so, like, that's true. I am a Catholic, but my dad was Jewish, so one full half of my family, you know, is Jewish, and it's very complicated as to, like, what that means for someone in my position, you know, especially when it's your father's family, not your mother's family, you know, but in any event. Listen, there's one thing to know about the situation in Israel now that I didn't know until I went there. And this is something that I heard from everyone, from a member of the war cabinet who I spoke to just people who I met on the street or taxi drivers, whoever. This is the bottom line. However this conflict ends, it cannot end in such a way that Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran believe that they have moved the ball forward on their goal of destroying the state of Israel. Because if they believe that that's true, they're going to do it again and again and again. And every person that I spoke to in Israel spoke with a single voice and said, we can't have that. You can't. You can't come across the border and murder people in kibbutzes and music festivals and rape them and take selfies. No. So that's it. It doesn't matter what Joe Biden says. It doesn't matter what the UN says. They're going to finish it.
Okay, let me reserve that question for the follow-up in a moment. One of the things that I think is different about this war that maybe people don't get, and maybe the Israelis aren't so sure about either, but maybe they are, is it seems to me that all the major wars Israel has been engaged in since its founding, four or five of them now, none of them have really ended in a decisive end, victory. They have not been like the end of World War II for the Allies. They have not ended with a decisive, clear winner, clear victor, clear defeated, with clear demarcations and clear suits for peace. I think this is different, at least at the leadership of the Israeli government's positioning. I think they realize this one we cannot end like all the others.
Yeah, no, look, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, listen, I might argue that 73 was that kind of victory, and then okay. The U.S. said to Israel, like, hey, why don't you give Egypt the Sinai back? We'll give you military aid. Everything will work out, right? Okay. And Israel said, okay. Right? Because Israel always says okay. Five times over 100 years, the Palestinians have been offered a state. Not only do they always say no, but every time peace gets close to being at hand, the terrorists get more violent because they don't want two states. They just don't. All they want is the destruction of Israel. And I mean, that's sort of the paradigm shift that I think certainly Americans on the left, but even some Americans on the right need to understand. Like, Hamas doesn't want a two-state solution.
When Hamas spokesmen here and there come up to a media outlet and say, we are willing to negotiate, we are willing to recognize Israel, you say what?
I mean, I'm not aware of a Hamas spokesman who's ever said that they're willing to recognize Israel. I mean, in their 1988 charter, is, you know, their founding principle is destroying Israel. Okay. Now, you know, listen, the name of the game here is de-radicalization. And everyone that I speak to, there's two models in that region. They're imperfect models, but the models that are looked at are Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, right? These are both countries that have made overtures to Israel. These are both countries where, like, people aren't, you know, putting on suicide vests. And so you say, okay, what are they doing right? You know, that's what you have to look at. The wild card is Qatar, because on the one hand, you say, oh, isn't Qatar wonderful? They're facilitating the peace talks. On the other hand, Qatar runs Al Jazeera. Guess who's funding all the campus crazies?
Yeah, right.
Qatar is.
Right.
Guess who's funding all the people who are, like, going crazy on the streets of New York and San Francisco in their pro-Hamas rallies? Qatar is. So this is all very complicated stuff, man.
The that it kind of drives one to this notion when people do talk about a two-state solution, though, David, because you do hear it an awful lot, at least in America. People will say, well, until there's a two-state solution, you're going to continue to have terrorist outbreaks and terrorism, such as you saw from Hamas, such as you see in the Palestinian Authority as well. I don't want people to neglect and think that that is some kind of Valhalla of peace. It is not. But what seems to me when people like Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or others say you will have terrorism until there is a two-state solution, they fail to understand that what you said, every time they've been offered it, they've turned it down and more terrorism comes, because it's a nice, convenient talking point, but it is not the essence of what they are demanding. It is not at the basis of their demand. The two-state solution to them is merely a means to an end. It is not an end. I have to take a commercial break. Can I have you respond to that when we come right back?
Of course.
Thank you. David Marcus is our guest. Follow him on Twitter X at Blue Box Dave. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. David Marcus is my guest, writer and columnist. Follow him on Twitter X, what we call Twix, at Blue Box Dave. You can read him at the Daily Mail, any other of number of places. Just back from Israel, Mr. Marcus, I wanted to talk to you about a few of the talking points that involve the situation and the war with Israel. And we were just on one of them right before the break. The phrase two-state solution, which keeps tripping off so many tongues, I think what people – well, I would like to know what your response is to the notion that there will be continued terrorism until there is a two-state solution. I'll tell you what I think, but I would you were just there. I would like to hear what you have to say. There will be terrorism until there is a two-state solution.
Well, listen, nobody that I spoke to in Israel – has any interest in even discussing a two-state solution right now. Most of the people I spoke to thought it would be decades before anybody's willing to even entertain that notion. I think the two-state solution idea is pretty much dead right now.
Should it be? Now, should it be dead?
Yes, right now I think so, because here's the problem, right? Like, one of my initial reactions to October 7th, right, was to remember that, you know, you brought up my religion, right? I was an Irish Catholic, and in the 1980s in Philadelphia, a lot of Irish Catholics had sympathies to the IRA,
right?
Including members of my family. And we knew that sometimes Protestant civilians died, and that was viewed as a tragedy, right? That was never celebrated.
Right.
Had the IRA ever gone to the Glastonbury Music Festival and done what Hamas did, their support in the United States would have evaporated overnight.
Interesting.
Right? Their support in the Republic of Ireland would have evaporated overnight, because a terrorist organization can only do what the people supporting it will tolerate, right? Iran's not taking their support back. Hezbollah's not. Russia's not. China's not. North Korea's not. So apparently they think this is a legitimate way to conduct, I don't know, armed resistance, Judith Butler calls it. So this is civilizational stuff, and you can't there's a certain point at which, like, how do you negotiate with that?
The other phrase that trips off the tongues of a lot of people is, well, let's remember, not every party here is innocent. Israel is a colonialist settler country, and I happen to think that it might be one of the few countries in the world that actually is not, by definition. And if you want a good example of one that might be, Jordan could be. Why is Jordan not the two-state solution?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great question, right? I mean, there's also Lebanon, which was really specifically set aside to be like the Christian Arab country, and now is like not that at all. but instead is like occupied by Hezbollah, which is basically Iran. So no, I mean, look, the whole region is screwy. But I do think it's interesting. The one member of the war cabinet who I talked to, he said something that I thought was interesting. He said that the Arabs really look at Israel as another crusader kingdom. Mm. Mm. You know, and I'm a bit of a student of the Crusades, and being in Jerusalem last week, that was, you know, it was part of what, you know, I found sort of so remarkable about it. But like, the one thing that the Crusaders, you know, they took Jerusalem in 1099. They held it for almost 100 years, right? Mm-hmm. Israel's at about 75. The one thing the Crusaders never really managed to do was get enough Western Catholics or Christians mm-hmm. to move there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they were always still this sort of like small minority that they were technically ruling. Israel's different. Like Israel, you know, because of the diaspora, because of what happened after World War II, Israel has created an organic Western state in the middle of the Levant. And, you know, for people who haven't been there, I don't know if you've been there, man. Like, it's worth going. It's a pretty remarkable place.
No, I have been several times, but most recently would have been 2019, so not any time in the past. Well, obviously not since you've been there.
But you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean. It's a very interesting place, and there's old and there's new. You had mentioned in a recent call, might have been today's, I don't remember, a visit to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Was that in this today's column? It doesn't really matter, but you had mentioned a visit to it. And one of the things I found most remarkable about, I put a few things together on the last trip that I had not noticed in previous trips. When I went to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, I heard what you heard, which is this loud blasting Muslim call to prayer that enters into the church, which I think is maybe what, one of the holiest, if not the holiest site in Catholicism? It might be.
It's up there.
It's up there. And they five times a day tolerate that blast of Muslim prayer into it. I noticed that there is a disputed place where they think Jesus may have arisen called the Garden Tomb. I don't know if you went to that place on this visit, and they think they have the Rock of Golgotha there as opposed to it's a debate, and I think it's a Protestant Catholic thing a little bit, but
sure.
But where they think Golgotha is, the Arab municipality plastered a bus stop over it. There is this effort when people talk about coexistence that kind of like those coexistence bumper stickers. One of these things doesn't belong because they don't understand or abide by the word or phrase coexistence. They are trying to obliterate everything and strut everywhere through other religious claims to that territory they can, perhaps starting most visibly with where the Dome of the Rock is.
Yeah, I mean, listen, that you know, you talk about like apartheid or like you can't go.
Yeah,
the only place I wasn't able to go last week in Jerusalem was to Al-Aqsa.
Right. Right.
Right. I wasn't allowed to go there.
Right. You would taint it.
Right. Everywhere else I was able to go, right? The Western Wall, I was able to go to the Christian Quarter, you know, and it is, it's such a, and I'll tell you a funny thing, like, you know, because you said you were there in 2019, like, one of the things that I was given to understand is that it was really empty, right? Because, like, war kind of dampens tourism, I guess.
Yeah, it tends to, right. Yeah.
And so, like, I'm wandering around, and, like, there weren't, like, a lot of fanny packs.
Yeah.
You know, there was almost nobody at the Western Wall. I was like, you know, this is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, you feel the echoes of all of these centuries and of all of the things that happened there, right? Like, my name's David. It's his city. Like, it's a wild experience.
Do you have one more brief segment available to you?
I do.
I would love to exploit it. David Marcus, thank you. I got to take a quick commercial break. I do want to talk to you about Rafah and Gaza when we come right back. David Marcus is just himself back from Israel. Read his stuff everywhere. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Privileged to have David Marcus with us, a writer living in West Virginia. He writes on a lot of different platforms. Probably the easiest way to follow his work is through his Twitter X Twix account, at Blue Box Dave. By the way, what Blue Box? Where does the name Blue Box? Do you shop at Tiffany's a lot, Dave Marcus?
I don't. I am a Doctor Who fan, but that's not it either. No, so I mentioned earlier that my background was in theater, so the theater company that I co-founded was called Blue Box Productions, my Twitter account was from when I was still doing theater, so I just never changed it.
Nice. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
David, we were talking about your most recent trip you just back from in Israel. All the merits of all the arguments that we have gone through for the past 35 minutes on the one hand. On the other, people look at southern Gaza and they see a awfully terrible situation with a lot of people who are in really bad shape, including children. What do you say when there is an obstinacy to the point that when Israel is obstinate about not going into Rafah, when Biden and Harris tell Israel you cannot go into Rafah, and Israel's obstinate, what do you say?
They're going to go into Rafah for exactly the reason that I said, you know, at the top of the show, which is that if this ends and Hamas thinks that they've moved the ball forward on their goal of destroying the state of Israel, then they're going to be October 7th over and over and over again. Israel's not going to let that happen. I can't stress enough how irrelevant Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and the UN and anybody else is right now. It's every person on the street in Israel is unified behind the idea that, like, you can't let Hamas exist next to us or it's going to happen again. So that's the reality on the ground. And listen, Israel is not Ukraine, right? Israel isn't begging for anything. Most people tend to think Israel is a nuclear power, right? They're capable of taking care of themselves. I wish the Biden administration, you know, would do the right thing and rally up behind them, but it's frankly kind of irrelevant.
Do you agree? I saw Dennis Prager debating someone, Reza Aslan, I think it was, and Piers Morgan the other day, and they were asking him about the children and the collateral deaths in Gaza. And they asked Dennis if he had in any way a hurt heart over it. And he said, I do. And I have a hurt heart over every innocent woman and child who died in Germany between 1940 and 1945. But every one of those deaths is Germans' fault, not ours and not Winston Churchill's. Do you agree with that?
I do. And listen, it's horrible because war is horrible, right? But you know, I went to a kibbutz called Kfir Aza right on the Gaza border. I mean, I could throw a baseball and hit Gaza. I saw bombs going off in Gaza from this kibbutz, right? This is where, you know, hundreds of Hamas terrorists poured through the gate, murdered kids, right? Everybody just murdered people. You know, but you want to know what happened after that? What happened after that was a couple thousand civilians came over and looted the houses. And that's the God's honest truth, man. You know, I watched the IDF video taken by Hamas themselves of dragging these bodies back into Gaza and civilians kicking the bodies, spitting on them. I don't know what to do about that, man. Again, the key is de-radicalization, but right now, today, I'm not convinced that the people of Gaza don't support Hamas.
Well, David, all I can do is thank you for your witness.
I have interviewed any number of people who aren't Jewish on this, who have their moral compass in the right direction, and all I can say is thank you, because Israel couldn't do it without non-Jewish support like yourself, as Jews anywhere in the world can't exist without non-Jewish support from people whose moral compass is pointed in the right direction like yourself. So I don't want anyone to ever think I, for one, take it for granted. I don't. I thank you, sir.
I appreciate that, but let me tell you something. There was that Economist cover, right? Israel alone.
Yeah.
If it comes to it, they're not going to lose, man.
Okay.
They didn't lose in 48. They didn't lose, you know, in 73. They're not going to lose.
From your mouth. Thank you, David. God bless you.
Yeah. Okay.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.